Because stories of police brutality and racial prejudice appear so often in the news, much attention has been paid to how black people, black men in particular, are perceived in society. Michael Denzel Smith, the contributing writer for The Nation, looks at it from a black male perspective in his new book called Invisible Man, Got the Whole World Watching, A Young Black Man's Education. It's published by Nation Books, and I'm very pleased it has brought Michael Denzel Smith to our show now. Welcome.
Thank you for having me.
Now, you have borrowed from a Mos Def track called Hip Hop for your title here. I'm assuming also fully aware of the fact that Ralph Ellison wrote a book called Invisible Man.
Yes, indeed.
So he was quoting from Ralph Ellison's novel. Which was more of an influence on you?
Well, I'm taking both, and I think it's important to note the context in which Mos Def was using that allusion to Invisible Man. It's that taking note in the previous lyrics of the sort of movement of black men through economics and different societal positions up until Ellison's Invisible Man, and with the framework that Ellison gave us for understanding black male life through this lens of invisibility, that one can be seen in society but have things assumed about you, your life treated in certain ways that in which your interior is not considered. And Mos Def then using that to say, well, we've reached a point in 1999 when he said this lyric, we've reached a point where a culture created mostly by young black men is a global phenomenon. And quite literally, the whole world is watching those who have been deemed invisible. And so what the book is doing is unpacking what that meaning is now for us in what was the Obama era.
The Ellison novel has become a classic. It was it was seen as a revelation at the time. Is what he wrote still relevant today? Does it still feel relevant?
In certain ways, absolutely. I think that the impulse for me to write this book was the genesis is with the killing of Trayvon Martin, when George Zimmerman killed Trayvon Martin, and every discussion.
That's when you started thinking about writing the book.
Yeah. In every discussion that we were having sort of broadly after that killing, that shooting, you can see the vestiges of that framework that's playing out, right? Like the idea of the way in which Zimmerman viewed Trayvon, the things that he was assigning to his character on the basis of simply his existence and his physical appearance. But then the things that were being assigned to Trayvon in death to justify Zimmerman viewing him that way and shooting and killing him.
Well, you have described a number of the victims of these murders as martyrs, but often we are reminded after the death that the person who died had been a less than admirable character. They had been engaged in a robbery or were selling things illegally on the street. Does that take away from their martyrdom?
No. No, absolutely not. And I think that for me, is an idea that we have to continually challenge, that somehow these people were deserving of death on the basis of these behaviors. Like, is death the sentence for, like, stealing cigarillos, like Michael Brown was apparently doing before he was killed? Like, is death the sentence for jaywalking? Is death the sentence for walking outside in a neighborhood that you may be deemed suspicious in the rain, as Trayvon Martin was doing?
Or selling loose cigarettes.
Selling loose cigarettes or playing loud music. Are these is death supposed to be the punishment for doing those things? And obviously that's so wrapped up in a sense of blackness as a mode of understanding who is and who is not worthy of basic human dignity and human rights. And so when we render certain folks disposable in that way, we do start to view those behaviors as justifiable for the killing of them.
What was your childhood like? Were you thinking along these lines when you were a kid? Were you aware of the inequities of our society?
I wouldn't say that I was totally aware. What I can say is that there were different moments where it started to become more clear to me. And I think in part... My mother did stress a lot for me to learn Black history. She recognized that in school I wasn't going to get a whole lot of it, so she wanted to ensure that, like, the books that I was reading, even what I was interested in at the time, I was sort of, like, interested in, like, reading mystery books and things around sports and stuff. She wanted to supplement that with, you know, famous Black authors and Black history to ensure that I understood the history of it. But what my parents also wanted was for me to feel as if I wasn't limited by my race in terms of what I could do with my life. So I think I internalized a lot of that feeling to and believed then that the barriers for my own personal success did not exist outside of the limitations of what I would do with my life.
Did they tell you that someday you could grow up and become president?
Yeah, absolutely. So they said that over and over.
How old were you when Barack Obama was elected for the first
time? I was 21, about to turn 22. It was 2 days before my 22nd birthday.
And I'm sure that you were just thrilled. Has he... Did he live up to your expectations?
I didn't have expectations. I was...
You didn't have expectations?
I didn't have expectations. I voted for Obama with an understanding of the limitations of representational politics, that just simply electing the first Black president was not going to be the sort of salve that so many people wanted it to be in terms of the dismantling of institutional racism. So with other reservations around his politics, so I did rejoice in the election of Obama, because it's a very visceral reaction that I was having to seeing him, seeing Michelle and Sasha and Malia sort of walk out and become sort of American royalty. Like, that's not something that Black folks have had access to, right? So, like, the visceral reaction to that was very much a sense of pride and joy that happened. But the reality of the 8 years of the Obama presidency were that we were still in this uphill battle against institutional racism and the powers of white supremacy, and that in part the election of Barack Obama was allowing people, like certain people, especially white people, to say that the problem had been solved.
But how did you interpret the people who claimed that he wasn't born in the United States, that he was born in Kenya, that he wasn't a Christian, as he said he was, but he was a secret Muslim?
Oh, that's straight up racism, right? Like, that just
that
is.
Was it.
That's straight up racism. And it's to be anticipated, particularly when, the presidency has come to embody everything that we know of as the American identity. And it's for 43 presidents, it had been white men. And then here comes 44, and the shift, it's threatening to the American identity and those who believe America to be their birthright, their inheritance, and all the spoils of American empire, and everything belongs to them. And now at the head of that is a Black man, and that is, like, that's unsettling for a lot of people. And the backlash was swift, and the backlash was real, and we're still living with the backlash in the election of Donald Trump. Like, this is what it looks like for any step of American progress. There's an intense backlash, and it started with the Tea Party, and it started with questioning of his birth and demanding to see his birth certificate, and the ideas around the Islamophobic idea that if he were Muslim, he could not effectively serve as the president of the United States. All of these things are related to just a simple nativism and racism that still animates American politics and culture.
My guest is Michael Denzel Smith, who is a contributing writer for The Nation magazine. He's also written for The New York Times, Atlantic, The Guardian, Root, Salon, BuzzFeed. He's been a featured commentator on NPR, BBC Radio, CNN, MSNBC, HuffPost Live, and more. And now he's written a book called Invisible Man. What is Invisible Man is the original title. Invisible Man Got the Whole World Watching. I'm always confused by the way they publish these things, put these things on the cover. The big word here is world. So do I start off with world watching Invisible Man Got the Whole? A Young Black Man's Education is the subtitle. It is published by Nation Books. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. You chose to go to an all-black college.
I did.
You probably had the opportunity to go to any school you had wanted to, or most of the schools you'd wanted to.
I guess I could have, but I didn't apply anywhere else.
Why?
My thinking at the time was that I wasn't going to get the type of training to be the kind of black person that I wanted to be in the world going anywhere other than a historically black college. I wanted an education that was going to train me up to be to rebel against a system that devalued my life. And unfortunately, I didn't get that.
How did you perceive your classmates the first year you were at school?
Yeah, what I recognize is that I went to Hampton University, which is a private school, which requires a lot of resources to be able to attend. And the folks that wanted to attend that school, for the most part, were very interested in sort of an assimilationist attitude, right? Like the climbing of the corporate ladder and like opening doors for more black people to be able to climb that ladder. Like they were going to set an example by being the most respectable, the most well-dressed, the most well-educated and most well-spoken. And they were going to, in many ways, prime the pump for white people to say, well, if this one isn't so bad, then we can hire more that look like them and act like them. And I think that that bothers me so much still, in that we're then committed to a performance of respectability in terms of that in terms that have been set by the dominant culture of white supremacy that have written us out of respectability in the first place. Like you can, like there simply is no way to be respectable as a black person. I mean, like we're sitting with the first black president for 8 years, and I mean every credential that he has would speak to his comporting to every norm and more of our society. He is married to a woman, has 2 children. He graduated from all of the right colleges. He dresses in a suit, and he is very, like, he's knowledgeable on a number of topics. And yet you still have people calling him a African witch doctor. You still have all of the blatant disrespect. I mean, the "you lie." Like, remember that from
Joe supposedly
Wilson? Like,
there on the internet, there are claims that he's gay, that Michelle is a transsexual, that the children had been kidnapped. So, and yet his popularity, his ratings were higher in this last year than they ever were. And at the same time, many of the people who voted for him in the last election voted for Donald Trump.
And
does that mean America's very confused?
I think we have to understand that this is simply the course of American history, right? So when you, as I was saying earlier, when you have a moment of black progress, and this happened post-Civil War and post-Reconstruction, this happened all during, this is what gave birth to Jim Crow. This has happened right after the Civil Rights Movement made many strides. You have a moment in which there is a panic. There is the idea that essentially the country is being taken over by some outside threat, by some foreign threat, even though it is homegrown, right? Like, black people are homegrown. We exist here. That it is going to disrupt the American identity. And when that is so tied to white male heteropatriarchy, anything that disrupts that is going to pose an existential threat to so many. And so when you have 8 years of Obama, which is not, it's not total progress, but it is some form of progress, you have people retreating because they are fearful of what comes on the other side if the too much progress is made. And so Donald Trump can employ the same slogan, the same campaign slogan as Ronald Reagan, because they're performing the same function. They want to make America great again, which is just to return to a time in which you did not have to respect the human rights and human dignity of other people.
Many of the people in the alt-right seem to be arguing that they have lost rights in recent years. What rights might they have lost?
They haven't lost any rights. What they've lost is the privilege of saying that they have more rights than everyone else, right? So, like, even the incremental gains that we have made, like, this is why during the healthcare debate, when we get the Affordable Care Act and it's called Obamacare, people are talking about it as a form of welfare and saying this is reparations, like you can't argue anything else. And it's because the sense that now more people, particularly poor Black folks, will at the very least have health insurance means that I can't measure myself against that and know who I am anymore. The threat is to the identity that Blackness being on the bottom provides for white folks. It's like, as long as I'm struggling, but Black people are struggling more, I know where I am and I know where I'm placed. If we're on equal footing, that disrupts my sense of self and who I will be in this world. And so the idea that you are losing rights doesn't make any sense. No one has dictated that you no longer can have health care. What's being said is that other people should have it. Like, we're not saying that no one you should not have a job. We're saying that other people should be able to have access to jobs, particularly when historically unemployment rates have been so low for Black people, right? Like, but the problem is that is seen as a threat because that then means that you are being equal with someone where the very inequality of that person's existence has provided you with the identity that you hold dear.
My guest is Michael Denzel Smith. His book, Invisible Man, Got the Whole World Watching, A Young Black Man's Education, is published by Nation Books. We will take a little break and come back with more. But we're going to go into this break with a bit of the song that we talked about earlier, Hip Hop by Mos Def.
We went from picking cotton to chain gang line shopping to bebopping to hip hopping. Blues people got the blue chip stock option. Invisible man got the whole world watching. Where you at? I'm high, low, east, west, all over your map. I'm getting big props with this thing called hip hop. Where you can either get paid or get shot. When your product gets stocked, the fair weather friends flock. When your chop position dropped and the phone calls. Chill for a minute, let's see who else hot. Snatch your shelf spot. Don't gas yourself out. The industry just a better built cell block. A long way from the shell towns and the bells that L rock, 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 rock.
And we are back with Michael Denzel Smith. His book, Invisible Man, Got the Whole World Watching, is published by Nation Books. When you worked at Walmart in 2005, you were approached by three people. Who were they, and what was your reaction to them?
That was 2005, and I was approached by three Marines, and they were recruiters. They were the effort to recruit particularly young men into the armed forces at the time had been ramped up because enlistment was down due to the ongoing Iraq war and the engagement in Afghanistan. And that summer, I had been approached a number of times by recruits. I live in Virginia Beach, Virginia, and it's a very heavy military population. It's that's how I ended up there is because my dad was in the Navy, served in the Navy for 20 years. Norfolk is the largest naval base in the world, which is a neighboring city. And so I'd always been around sort of military culture and seen all of the uniforms and stuff, but it was the first time where I experienced folks walking up to me and asking if I thought about joining up. And I was just it was a hot day and I was working too hard that day and I was just irritated and had reached my breaking point with these folks approaching me, essentially trying to recruit me to fight in a war that I did not believe in, that I felt was immoral, unethical, and violent. I essentially cursed them out because I did not feel I felt like they were at the not just recruiting any young men, they were targeting specifically young Black men for this war.
Because you bring up a phrase, cog or killer,
yeah,
in this context.
Yeah, and that's the feeling that you get when it's like, on the one hand, I'm working at Walmart and I'm working for this large corporation and making no money not money that's not commensurate with the level of physical labor that I was doing, or like the other option, it feels like for young black men was either work that job or to join the military and simply be a contract killer.
In talking about Trayvon Martin earlier, we talked about the concept of martyrs, and you point out that most of the victims that we discuss in that context are black males. Are incidents of police brutality against black women perceived differently? I'm thinking about Sandra Bland, of course.
Yeah, I think that the problem is that they're too often overlooked, and there are a number of reasons for that. But what it comes down to is that we don't pay as much attention to the ways in which police violence enacts itself in the lives of black women, not just from the perspective of them losing husbands and sons in that respect, but like Sandra Bland was arrested and she was found dead in a cell. Whether or not she killed herself, which it looks likely that she did, but the fact of the matter is that she was arrested and detained for things that she didn't need to be arrested and detained for. It was the fact of like black women having attitude and speaking back.
But you also say that black women are often the engines that move protests of racial injustice. And it's been argued that the civil rights protests in the South in the early 60s only had an impact when young whites joined in and Goodman and Schwerner were killed along with Cheney.
Well, certainly, but the day-to-day work of movement building has always fallen on the shoulders of black women, right? Like, I mean, and we're not talking about the speech giving and all of that, like, that gets the headlines. It's who is printing the flyers, who is, like, in charge of the carpools, who is in charge of making meals, who does, like, in the meeting speaks up to, like, strategize, right? Like, who's developing that strategy on the ground, who has made sacrifices in terms of, like, particularly when you're talking about, like, bus boycotts, who are making the sacrifices in terms of being arrested for refusing to give up their seats. Like, over and over again, it's black women, in part because the terror that they were facing on this was not just the dehumanization of being made to sit in the back of the bus, but the sexual violence that they were facing at the hands of white bus drivers.
So why weren't they in the leadership ever? I mean, when we think back to that time, of course, Martin Luther King, but also Stokely Carmichael, Robert Moses.
Patriarchy is a hell of a drug. You know, I think, and it seduces so many to believe that essentially the natural roles for black women were in the background. I mean, Stokely Carmichael said that, right? Like, later Kwame Ture, he said that straight out. And that, like, part of that comes out of a lot of this was church folks, and that's the structure that they understood, is a male leading the flock. But, like, that's ingrained in our culture, is that the folks who take on those responsibilities of leadership should be men.
You write about how homosexuality is perceived in the black community. And there are many people who object to homosexual rights as being civil rights. They see it as separate from the black civil rights. This is something that you and your father argued over.
That bothers me on a number of levels. For one, it just completely negates the existence of black gay folks altogether.
But does this come out of the attitudes that come from the church?
It certainly has been influenced, and I think that that's part of, like, it's we can't, I don't want anyone getting the impression that I'm saying that black folks are more homophobic than anyone else. I think that homophobia is a global problem, and then in this context, it is a total American problem. But what happens is that when you have a people who are devoted to an idea of liberation that is essentially mimicking the dominant culture, right? That when white folks are seen as successful because they have a heteropatriarchal family structure that they abide by, that it is man and woman married to one another, man is head of household. You get in the heads of people who are oppressed that that is what freedom looks like, that's what liberation looks like, and that's what we should be mimicking. And then when you add the religious element, it only intensifies. And so the disrespect, the degradation and denigration of queer, gay folks, identified folks, takes on a different type of resonance within black communities.
But how does it work in the context of a sense of black masculinity?
It is it's seen as a threat to that, right? Like the idea that one could be gay is antithetical to what our historical notions of what black masculinity constitutes, because what black masculinity has been constructed in opposition to has been white supremacy. And what has been viewed is that you need things that are like, you need the hypermasculinity, you need the strength, you need the willingness to fight back. And homosexuality has been viewed as a weakness, and so if you cannot then be a proper black man and engage in that as a sexual behavior, a sexual identity, and then be prepared for the real fight at hand. And I think that we have to, one, acknowledge the existence of folks who live at the intersections of blackness and black identity, and also queer identities, gay and lesbian identities, and note that those people do exist. And then, two, note that the writing off of that of queer and gay identities and bisexual identities as somehow weak only weakens our liberation fight.
Have you spoken about this with your father since you had your little disagreement watching a television show?
No, not particularly. But we've not in,
was it,
not
it was
in
a
the,
movie.
Not in those words. What happened was this was after the it was the year where Brokeback Mountain mm-hmm. was a big Oscar contender, and the day after it had lost the Oscar race, but there was like a special on TV with Oprah hosting, and my dad was watching, and I was there with him, and he said he invoked a homophobic slur in my presence, and at that time, like, I just sort of walked away from it. Later conversations that my father and I have had, like, we haven't talked about that specific incident, but it has been made very clear that I do not agree with his views on like gay and lesbian people. That he embraces a level of homophobia that I believe to be violent and immoral.
Have you found yourself over the years at odds with people within the community on all sorts of things? I'm thinking about when you were writing for your college newspaper and there was the Jenna 6 incident.
Yeah, that's the moment where I think I became a writer, particularly because I understood what the power of words could be, because the administration at Hampton University, I butt heads with them. It seemed to me that they didn't want to, they were asking the student body in a number of ways to not rock the boat, to not be rebellious, to not follow in the footsteps of the generations that they had such admiration for, and told us that we weren't living up to their example, and told us that we weren't living up to their legacy. And then here was a moment where we were attempting to, and Hampton University administration was blocking us from doing so. And I wrote a lot of things in response to that, including my first op-ed that year, where I said that Hampton University hates black people. And I would use different language now, but the sentiment that I was trying to express was simply that I believe that by standing in the way of a generation attempting to stand up for the rights of these young men who have been charged with, who have been overcharged for their participation in a schoolyard fight, was standing in the way of our new understanding about what the fight looked like for black liberation in the United States.
Were you surprised when Dave Chappelle hosted Saturday Night Live a couple of weeks ago?
I was a little surprised.
Because you write about being a fan and then your reaction to his decision to quit. Many people felt that was foolish because he had a really powerful position.
Yeah, but, you know, in the book, the way that I discuss it and what he has said is just like the position that he was put in, you know, in... The show had a lot of really biting, smart things to say about race and racism in the United States. At the same time, what Dave Chappelle was becoming famous for was not that. He was becoming famous for things that were a little more silly, a little more like the catchphrase that he was being famous for. And he felt like the audience then was changing and they weren't keeping up with him on the other things that he was trying to do. And so it wasn't worth it to him to get that sort of laughter that made him very uncomfortable and made him feel like he was not living up to a social responsibility that comes with that audience and comes with that power.
You also write about mental illness as being a problem within the black community in a sense because many men feel that they can't admit to having a problem.
Right, and this is tied up in different aspects of both blackness and masculinity in that we as a people have survived so much violence and trauma in this country that it is perceived that, like, if you need some type of, like, if you need that institution of, like, professional mental health, you're not living up to the legacy of strength that your ancestors have set forth. But then there's also problems of access. I mean, it's just, like, we don't have a right to health in our country. And then mental health, carrying the stigma that it does, is less funded and less accessible to folks. But then there's also sort of that masculine idea that one does not talk about feelings at all, like in any way whatsoever. So like there's a combination of factors that lead to then folks either not making that a part of our advocacy and activism and not making it a part of our personal desire.
When DMC of Run DMC fame was on our show, he described how therapy had helped him. He was kind of proud of it. But you've had to deal with this on a personal level.
I did. I was in therapy right after I did not graduate from college. But that time right after the school year ended, I needed to go to therapy because I was in a state where I was having massive panic attacks. Hard.
Do you know why?
Well, yeah, there's a lot of different things wrapped up in there. A lot of it has to do with living through survivor's guilt. My cousin Demetrius Funderburk was killed when I was 12 years old and he was 17. And that death hit me very hard. And I did not discuss my feelings. I did not discuss my feelings around that. And I went through a major depression my senior year of high school that almost threatened my graduation. And even after that, I didn't deal with it. And so during these major moments of accomplishment for myself, I go through the survivor's guilt once again.
Well, on that happy note, we end this conversation. Michael Denzel Smith, his book, Invisible Man, Got the Whole World Watching, A Young Black Man's Education, is published by Nation Books. It's been a real pleasure having you on our show.
It's my pleasure. Thank you.